Good morning. Welcome to Stage C. Before we start, I would like to remind you this is run by volunteers, and we need more volunteers, most notably to run the operate the camera and audio system. But there are all kind of things that we still need people to take shift for. So yeah, you should really go to volunteer.emfcamp.org. But for now, I will leave you with Caroline Graham, who is going to talk to you about open source.
Hello. First thing I should say is I am not a technology person. I am not even a technology lawyer. I'm a corporate lawyer. So I'm speaking to you about issues that arise from open source software, legal ownership and licensing, talking a little bit about the history and the development of open source and how it has come to the kind of legal status that it's at now, and looking at the future and how to put it on a more sustainable footing, because I think that we have some quite major issues about how sustainable open source is in the current environment, where largely it's being developed free of charge by people, which isn't really a model that can operate long term. My first encounter with open source is actually relatively recently, because being a corporate lawyer, I haven't had the kind of involvement as that an IT or an IP lawyer would have in this world. But I was contacted by a client, and I'll talk in a bit more detail about that later, just a few years ago, who they had issues with the ownership of their open source product, which they had been developing for many years, in a fairly sort of benign environment where they'd just been kind of developing it during the day as part of their everyday job. And changes in their employment environment meant that that was now becoming more challenging, and they wanted to protect the open source nature of the software that they had developed themselves over many years. And so what we did was, and I'll discuss that in a little bit more detail later on, we established a more sustainable ownership structure to operate that. But, can I hardly see here? Okay. So just for anybody who isn't sort of familiar with the way open source software is on a legal basis, it is software which is licensed. I think it's very commonly assumed that because something is open source, it's just out there and available. But there is a license that's axiomatic to the whole structure. The license is on certain terms. It is licensed free, hence the open nature of it. And it's on terms that grant certain freedoms to the licensee. What those freedoms are, though, it's incredibly difficult to see my notes, I apologize for this. What those terms are, I'll talk a little bit more about some of the main licenses that are available at the that people commonly use in open source, but it is important to realize that this is, when you use open source software, you're using it on the terms of a legal license, a legal contract. It's increasingly an important feature of the software landscape. Nearly all companies now, large groups and companies, are using some open source in their IT environment. That poses challenges of its own, though. A lot of people would argue that it's not being managed very strategically in those organizations because it's not being paid for and not having to go through a procurement process. It may be being seen as more of a free-for-all within IT departments and development departments. I really can't see what I'm doing here. But as mentioned, there are a variety of licensing structures that are available, and we'll talk about some of those in a bit more detail. So it has become increasingly important in the commercial environment. Number of reasons for that. Obviously, a lot of technological change. Now that we have more sort of software-oriented architecture, now that we've got more cloud-based, internet-based, oh, is there a... Oh, fantastic. That's a help. Good. Thank you. Now, let's see what I've written to what I'm going to talk about. And obviously, the proliferation of different platforms, different hardware platforms, have made open source software much more relevant in the technological space. The economic environment since 2008 has also meant that in order to achieve a sort of competitive advantage, people are looking for lower cost bases for their development projects. It's also regarded as more, you can innovate more quickly off an open source platform. And there is more collaboration possible in certain areas, which is seen as key in the economic environment now. And a changing strategic approach of large users, the flexibility and the shorter development times are seen as critical to just getting projects off the ground. So there's been a huge change in the way it's being used. Oh, that's a bit weird. Okay. So talk about the Free Software Foundation, founded in 1985 by Richard Stallman, and this was the beginning perhaps of the philosophy of open source. He was an academic at MIT. He was being required to operate, anything that he developed was going out on commercial licenses, and he was very unhappy with the way that was operating. And he left MIT and set up the Free Software Foundation to oversee the GNU project, the development of the operating system, which obviously became Linux, the kernel of Linux. GNU, I love that it actually stands, it's a recursive acronym, it stands for GNUs, not Unix. And this was an attempt to undermine the Unix dominance in the market. Four freedoms were those which he considered to be kind of key to what open source is. The right to run the software for any purpose, commercially or otherwise, anything you want to do. To access and freely adapt source code. To redistribute to anyone. But that's the interesting part of, I think, what Richard Stallman was trying to do. You are able to redistribute the software to anyone. You're able to adapt it and derive your own product from it. But when you do so, and this is the restrictive licensing model, when you do so, you are obliged to license whatever you've derived on the same terms. So you can't take the free software and essentially use it for commercial purposes. I'm just going to read a little bit from the GNU manifesto, the Free Software Foundation manifesto, which Richard Stallman devised, because I think that this kind of reflects the philosophical underpinning of the whole movement. It has many things are changing underneath this now, but I think this is useful. Richard Stallman said, "I consider it the golden rule requires that if I like a program, I must share it with other people who like it. Software sellers want to divide the users and conquer them, making each user agree not to share with others. I refuse to break solidarity with other users in this way. I cannot, in good conscience, sign a non-disclosure agreement or a software license agreement. So that I can continue to use computers without dishonor, I have decided to put together a sufficient body of free software so that I will be able to get along without any software that is not free. Once GNU is written, everyone will be able to obtain good system software free, just like air. This means much more than saving everyone the price of a Unix license. It means that much wasteful duplication of system programming effort will be avoided. This effort can go instead into advancing the state of the art. Extracting money from users of a program by restricting their use of it is destructive because the restrictions reduce the amount and the ways that the program can be used. This reduces the amount of wealth that humanity derives from the program. When there is a deliberate choice to restrict, the harmful consequences are deliberate destruction." So you can see it's very philosophical, very ideological, and a bit hippie-ish, really, a bit commie. And it was felt by the late 90s, as that sort of ideological approach was receding, it began to be felt that that was getting in the way of the wider adoption of open source. And the Open Source Initiative was set up in the late 90s with their own definition, and this essentially, on the slide, are the 10 components of the definition of open source software for these purposes. I think that perhaps the most interesting aspect of this is that that the authors of derived work can retain the source code, and that you have a freedom to distribute derived works on any terms you like. So in contrast to the GNU and the licenses on that model, you're allowed to make money off of it, in essence. So to come to that, we now are dealing with a variety of licensing models that operate in parallel. First, the restrictive or copyleft approach. This is in the model of the GNU license. This is the idea that whatever you derive from the open source software, you must license that on the same terms so that it carries on being a fully open source product. The GPL, the General Public License, is the kind of core example of this. Only a 36% market share now. In 2010, the GPL represented 64% of open source software, and now it's only 36. It's massively in decline as a model of licensing. The permissive license is very much in the ascendant. The MIT license is now accounts for 26% of the code license in open source, and in 2010 that was only 4%. Similarly, the Apache license, 16% now, only 4% in 2010. Another of those are the BSD licenses, accounts for about 6%. My personal favorite, less than 1% of the market, but it's the do what the fuck you want to public license. I think that's a great name, and it pretty much sums up what it's all about. This is the trend. We're going towards a permissive licensing structure, personally, because I'm attracted to the free-for-all model. I think it's a bit of a shame that we're going that way. But if it means that that the whole concept of open source is gaining more traction, then I guess it's a price worth paying. But I want to talk a little bit, because, as I say, I'm not a technology geek, but I am a legal geek. And I'm very interested in the way the GPL works. I find it a very subversive model of licensing. It takes what we normally expect intellectual property law to be doing and turns it on its head and turns it to the advantage of the licensee. We think about intellectual property law as protecting the intellectual rights of the creator, often referred to as creator's rights. That's what we tend to assume it's there to do. And what the GPL does is say that if you use what you have received under this license, what you're entitled to use under this license, you must license it back on the same terms. It perpetuates an open type of intellectual property ownership and intellectual property licensing. When I say, though, that we start from the point of view of thinking of intellectual property law as a protecting of somebody's rights, of enabling them to benefit financially, usually, from their own intellectual work. In fact, whilst that is true, if you go back to the original reasons for the patent system, which was the first of the intellectual property models to get developed, if you go back and look at where that comes from, the purpose of patent law originally was not to protect people's ownership, because people were doing that through secrecy. It was actually to achieve openness. It was to, you got the protection of the law only if you published the technology that you had developed. The idea was that it massively speeded up the progress of technological development by making prior inventions accessible and readable to the public, to people who might develop them. It moved it forward. And in that sense, the GPL is actually rather similar to that approach. It takes what has been achieved and says, develop it, but publish it. It just doesn't give people the commercial protection. And I'll come on to why I think that's an issue. As I say, it inverts what we usually think of as the purpose of the law. I also, as a legal geek, find the GPL quite exciting because it's got no governing law clause. It doesn't say it's governed by English law or New York law or Delaware law. It's just silent on the subject. So you go back to first principles. You have to go, okay, who is making the contract with whom, in what state? It's therefore, it can be interpreted differently under different legal systems. So that's great in certain environments. In the French courts, it's a real problem because the French legal system massively prioritizes creators' rights and intellectual property rights as a personal asset. And so the GPL is very difficult to operate in France. The key terms of the GPL are perpetual and irrevocable. So once you've granted the license, you can't pull it back. If you've issued your software under the GPL, there's no kind of pulling it back in and relicensing it on a different basis. It's out there and you can't revoke it. You have complete freedom as a licensee under the GPL to do whatever you like with the software, but as soon as you distribute or convey the software to anybody else, whether that's as itself or as part of a derived product that you've created, at that point, you are restricted in what you can do. You are, as I've said before, obliged to license it on the same terms. Any breach of the license, so if you purport to distribute the software and don't do so under the GPL, revokes your rights under the license that you're benefiting from. But that's really tricky as well, because what happens if you have licensed something that comprises the software that you're the beneficiary of, you on-license it to somebody else, what happens then? If your license is revoked, then you have nothing to license yourself. So the license is specific on that also. All downstream licensing is included in the original license, so it's a completely flat structure. There's no license and sub-license and sub-sub-license. It's just everybody benefits from the original software under the original license that it's sent out in, even if that now is part of a derived product. The Apache license is a little different. As I say, this is a permissive license that you can do what you like. So once again, perpetual and irrevocable. But in this case, it permits reproduction and the distribution of all of the original software and derivative works, and you can charge for that. You can do that on any terms you like. You're not obliged to replicate the terms of the license under which you benefit. There are conditions relating to attribution, so there you can do what you like with it. You're not allowed to claim that you created it. And derivative works, you can issue on any terms you like, essentially. The MIT license has four paragraphs in it. It's all on one page, and essentially it says you can do anything you like, but the author's attribution rights are protected, and that's broadly all it does. Very, very short form license. So looking at whichever model of open source you're operating, the original creator of the software, we've got to start looking, I think, now. As I say, I'm massively attracted philosophically to the idea that software is out there, it's a public good, you know, a force for good in the world, as I say on my slide. I'm very attracted to that idea. I'm very frustrated by part of Richard Stallman's, a part that I didn't read of Richard Stallman's FSF manifesto, where he says, surely software developers have a right to be rewarded for their work. And he goes, well, you don't have to be a software developer, which I just think is an absolutely ridiculous approach to these things. You know, everybody has the right to be rewarded for their work. We have somehow to establish, everyone has to eat, everyone has to pay the bills. We somehow have to set up a structure for open source software where that is achievable. And I'll come on to talk about different ways that we might do that. As I say, we are looking at the whole dichotomy. Is IP law, is the very existence of licensing and copyright and intellectual property rights in general, is this a force for protectionism, for me to protect the value of my intellectual work, or is it a force for progress in the world, for developing the state of the art quickly? There's an interesting question about who owns the IP in a large product that's been developed by many developers. In the nature of open source, in the nature of most, if you're employed by an organization to develop software for that organization, then anything you develop in your job becomes your employer's property, typically. It's in your employment contract, normally. On the other hand, if you're developing something as part of a community of developers for a large open source project, what happens? Who owns it? What is the nature of the intellectual property and the ownership of it? That might not seem massively important, because obviously it's being licensed openly, it doesn't really matter, but who then enforces the license? If the person who is entitled to enforce intellectual property rights is the owner of the intellectual property rights, if you've got a product that's got 300 or 3,000 different developers, all who have different bits of ownership within it, enforcement's an absolute nightmare. They could be in all sorts of different countries. As I've said, the GPL isn't jurisdiction specific, so you could be trying to enforce across many countries. It just is, it's unsustainable, it's impossible. So a lot of open source projects include a developer's agreement where each developer in the developer's community assigns the intellectual property in their work to the broader whole, so that it's all in one place in ownership terms. So I want to talk specifically about the Linux Foundation, because I think this is one of the most sustainable models. It was only founded in 2000. Obviously, Linux had been being developed for quite some time before that. And it has expanded its remit. Now, it isn't just focused on the development of Linux itself. It's trying to create the largest shared technology investment in history, is its mission statement. It's not just developing Linux. It's looking to be the main focus for any number of open source projects, cloud projects, Internet of Things projects. It's hosting various projects that are that have been initiated by other people. So it's really trying to broaden out its reach. But within just looking at the development of Linux and the way that has gone, there is a developers community. Many of you may have even been involved in that, people who are developing code and contributing it back under the GPL to Linux. They also have a full-time, you know, paid staff, and they therefore have to fund that. And so companies typically can become financial members of the Linux Foundation. And there are various tiers of membership, and to be a member buys you benefits such as the ability to kind of define what the next step or the next development steps should be for Linux. So the costs of it can be anything from $500,000 a year down to $5,000 a year, other sort of prices for the different tiers of membership. But if you think about a large organization, paying for Windows licenses instead of using Linux. You know, you're obviously talking about a massive saving. These companies, these big organizations, have a huge interest in making sure that Linux is up to date and carries on working. The Linux Foundation is set up as an Oregon State non-profit mutual benefit corporation. I've looked in great detail at its various constitutional documentation. It has these various classes of membership. It also has affiliates who are not financial members but are corporates, but who contribute in a non-financial way, typically by seconding or deploying some of their staff for some of their working time towards the Linux project. I'm going to talk about OpenFOAM, which is a client of mine. And as I said, my initiation into the world of open source came late and came through corporate law, not through intellectual property law. And it came through this outfit, OpenFOAM. They are they've developed a fluid flow modeling software, which is used a lot in the automotive sector, but in various other sectors, too, medically, indeed. And it was licensed on an open source model. It was under the GPL. The company that developed it was very happy for it to be open source. They were owned by an American company. The key developers in the company were doing a lot of the work. Although it was for open source, they were doing it as part of their day job. It was all very benign. And then the ownership changed. And the new owners were not happy for the developers to work on company time. And they were not happy that they were essentially looking for ways that they could take the software back, fork the software, and make it into a commercial product rather than an open source product. And the developers who had been involved in this from the start were very unhappy with that. So they came to me and asked if we could do something to get it onto a sustainable footing. So we looked in a lot of detail at Linux, at Genevi, Mozilla, Apache, various different models for owning this sort of product, and realized as we looked around that there was absolutely nothing in the UK that I could not find. I mean, I did a huge amount of digging on this and looked at many, many UK-owned open source software products. None of them were owned on anything approaching the Linux model or anything like it. Typically, what we were seeing was that they were owned by a one shareholder, one share company, licensed under the GPL or another open source license, but not owned in a way that would prevent or would give some kind of long-term security. And that might be okay if it's one person developing a small product for themselves, you know, which they're prepared to license until they decide not to anymore. That might be okay. I'm not sure it is, but it might be. If what you've got is a huge developers community or a substantial developers community and people are donating their time and their creativity, the idea that the rug could be pulled from under them, the idea that could just be forked and turned into a commercial product by the person who owns the underlying copyright, I think is seriously problematic in a developer's community. And this is where I'm at with when I'm talking about sustainable open source ownership. This is the thing that I think is really key. There's nothing comparable in the UK, and as I say, various issues with the one shareholder, one share model. Users community also, you know, if you're using a piece of software in your business, the idea that could just suddenly stop getting maintained, stop getting moved forward, is obviously a huge issue. So if we're trying to get open source more fully embedded in the corporate world, then that's not going to work either. So we looked at what we could do instead in the UK. Looking at Linux in particular, we don't have a structure in English company law, anything like the not-for-profit company corporation that they had in Oregon. But we decided we would create something as close as we could out of the company law vehicles that we had. We looked at community interest companies, which is a fairly new structure, essentially designed for the ownership of village halls. It wasn't going to do it for us. So we set up a company limited by guarantee. There's nothing to stop a company limited by guarantee from distributing its profits other than its own constitutional rules, but it's typically used in not-for-profit type organizations. It's also very difficult to just sell a company limited by guarantee. The transfer of ownership is more complicated and more involved. We designed the constitutional documents extremely carefully. We had a set of articles which dealt with the way in which the thing would be owned and the way in which corporate governance would operate, setting out the board, technical committee. We also had a set of rules which could be changed by the board, which are a little bit sort of lighter touch, which established the qualifications that members have to have and what kind of fees are going to be paid. Those sorts of things can be changed. We set it up with a model of financial membership so that any organisations that were using the software could elect to contribute financially. And as I said, they have an interest in that. They want to see the software maintained and developed. So it's not, on the one hand, procurement departments will look at it and say, well, why are we paying for something we can have for free? But there is an argument that can be made, and it can be justified. We then had contributing members, who are people, typically individuals, who are actually developing the software and contributing in their intellectual assets. And it was licensed under the GPL. We had a contribution agreement, which, as I mentioned before, it's very typical for the contributors to assign the benefit of their intellectual property rights, and that was done. Okay. And the GPL to ensure that we had the most restrictive license so that any developed products could not be forked. And having done this, just as far as I know, it's the only one still in the UK that's on this sort of basis. But I do think that it represents a possibility for a new paradigm, for a new way of thinking about open source, so that it stops being something that people who in the development community are essentially contributing to as a kind of charity project. It starts to actually be something that is sustainable and potentially remunerated. So solving the economic conundrum, the how do we reward developers for the work that they're doing in an open source environment where nobody is paying, the membership model seems to offer perhaps the best approach for that, and hopefully creating a genuinely open structure, a genuinely open ownership and sustainable for open source ownership in the future. That's me. If anyone wants to talk about this stuff, we've been told that we can take questions in these talks if there's a little bit of time. I think there's a few minutes. I can take a few questions, but I'll be around the festival until tomorrow.
I'm probably loud.
Wait for the mic.
Hello. Thanks for the talk. Really interesting. On the membership side, about to back with the open phone model, when you mentioned members, were you talking about members in the Companies Act kind of thing for voting rights and stuff like that, or just general associate members who pay and don't have anything else?
The thing about a guarantee company is that instead of being a member, we typically think of members and shareholders as synonymous, but a guarantee company doesn't have shares, so it doesn't have shareholders. A member of a guarantee company agrees to guarantee the liabilities of the company up to a certain threshold. What we didn't create that kind of membership in the case of Open Firm. They were members in a contractual sense, so that we had a membership agreement, and they have certain rights. They have certain committee attendance rights, so they can dictate or influence the future direction that the software takes. So we did it that way.
One last question, and then I'm sorry, but you are going to need to take it out.
So what are the, you know, from the point of view of setting up a legal structure like this in a community that may not presently have any kind of funding, how did the Open Firm Foundation overcome that?
Okay, well, in the case of Open Firm, as I say, it's fluid flow modelling that the software does, and it does it in a variety of different contexts. As I say, medically, it's used. They can actually model how injecting a liquid into a brain tumour will, how that liquid will flow through brain cells. But equally, it models how air flows around a particular shape of car. So it's a large number of automotive sector customers, as well as users, and those users were invited to join and to become members. And because their membership entitles them to influence the direction that the software development takes, and because the alternative is to buy a commercial license for another product, which would be considerably more expensive, a number of their users were willing to participate in that way. But of course, you do, you know, Linux is a similar model. People join, corporations join in order to influence the direction and in order to know that the product will continue to be developed and maintained and sustained. But you do have to have a sufficient user base, I think, to persuade anybody that, that this is something that is worth investing in. Okay.
So we are out of time, but yeah, if you have more questions, please go come find the speaker after. And thank you.
Thank you.